Hello, everybody, and welcome to our intro for the extended free preview of the What a Cartoon Movie episode all about The Road to El Dorado. I am one of your hosts, Bob Mackey, a super fan of the secret Elton John B-side. Hey, Armadillo, listen to the podcast to hear more about that. Who is here with me today?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and reminding you that friends never say goodbye.
It's true. That's also a song in the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And in case you didn't realize it from the intro up front, this month we are talking about the classic DreamWorks movie, The Road to El Dorado. Came out in 2000, was a massive, huge bomb, but now everybody loves it.
Yeah.
And we're going to investigate why in this ultra-long podcast. You're going to hear a very, very small portion of the history of The Road to El Dorado.
Mm-hmm. It's another installment in the Katzenberg Chronicles section, of which I think at this point is almost half of the podcast we've done on
yes.
this, for What a Cartoon Movie.
He has touched every animated movie in some way in America in the past 40 years.
But yeah, after the this is the one like right before Shrek, like so it's a good companion piece to the Shrek podcast, but also it has so much of the DNA of our last month's What a Cartoon Movie, Lion King. There's so much interesting going on in Road to El Dorado. Me and Bob learned so much about this film that, you know, both of us hadn't watched in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. It's the first time for me. So if you like what you hear after this intro and you want to hear the entire full thing, probably around 4 hours long, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up for $10 a month. You'll get to hear the rest of this podcast and also access everything else behind the What a Cartoon Movie paywall. That includes, how many hours is that, Henry? I know it's almost three entire years worth of 3 to 5 hour What a Cartoon Movie episodes.
You know, by my estimates, I'd say we're closing in on 170 hours mm-hmm. at this point. Yeah, it's so many. All of them are so much fun. Me and Bob put so much work both into finding the history on so many different films, and also we go like frame by frame in some cases through the movie. That's why they're sometimes over 5 hours long even, and mm-hmm. we have so much fun on them, and we've got some really good ones coming in the future too. But yeah, if you signed up now in that back catalog, our summer of the Disney Renaissance is right there for you. Us covering Hercules, Hunchback of Notre Dame, and The Lion King. So many in the back catalog, things like Shrek and Akira, Kiki's Delivery Service, and Beavis and Butthead Do America, Tiny Toons, How I Spent My Vacation, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, a giant catalog of them, and it's only getting bigger. Next month, if you sign up right now, you'll then get next month's of us doing Batman Beyond Return of the Joker, the direct-to-video Batman Beyond movie that seriously rules.
So yes, if you want to hear all that plus 100 plus episodes of our $5 miniseries, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up for $10 a month and you'll get access to all of that immediately. But for now, get ready to head down that trail we blaze with a brief preview of our very, very long podcast about The Road to El Dorado. But yeah, but I was happy to experience it. We'll talk more about our first impressions upon the movie chats when we talk about the movie itself and what happens in it. But for now, let's talk about the history of The Road to El Dorado. And I will say that Henry did an incredible history of DreamWorks and the founding of DreamWorks for our Shrek podcast we did in, I believe, April of 2021.
Yeah, it feels a while ago, but thank you, Bob.
That's, yes, for Shrek's 20th birthday. Mm-hmm. There was no 20th birthday for this movie.
Mm-mm. I mean, it happened during the pandemic. Actually, yeah. I guess it would have been the start of the pandemic in March of 2020. It would be the 20th anniversary.
Yes, that is very true. And we were all too busy panicking. So if you want to know the history of the founding of DreamWorks, go to that podcast. You have access to it if you're listening to this one. And if you're on the free feed listening to this, pay us $10.
Yeah.
And you can listen to that and a lot of other ones. But just know that they had two animated movies out before this one. There was both in 1998. Sorry, yeah. Ants and Prince of Egypt. So both in 1998, those were their two movies before Road to El Dorado. So that is the history of the timeline of DreamWorks, rather.
It was planned that Prince of Egypt would be the first one in their big prestige thing. But then out of jealousy for Bugs Life coming out, Katzenberg pushed as hard as possible to get Ants out the door before Bugs Life to fuck over his old teammates.
And there's a similar story with this one too.
All right,
we'll talk more about it. Yes,
I thought so.
When I read about it, I was like, how did I not figure this out? But okay, the year is 1994. I'm 12 years old. Super Metroid is out. It could be the best year of my life possibly until recently. So once again, it's time to talk about our friend he's sort of like the phantom third host of these podcasts, right?
Yeah.
Jeffrey Katzenberg. Yes, I believe this is like the seventh podcast in a row where we're talking about Katzenberg. Cool World now.
Cool
World now.
Cool World, but definitely Shrek and the entire Disney summer. And then this.
He's a frequent a subject on these podcasts. Again, I dare one of you out there to edit together the Katzenberg supercuts of all of our Katzenberg conversations.
But it's like when you're talking about 90s and early 2000s American theatrical animation, he's the most powerful film executive there was. Like, whether at Disney, for Disney, even after he left, he cast such a long shadow on it. Every choice was like, well, Jeffrey approved this 5 years ago, and now it's in the theater.
In fact, in some sources I read, they said, oh, actually, Jeffrey Katzenberg is the uncredited third director of this movie. I say, no, he's not.
No.
Maybe he thinks he
is. That's so lame. Remember, our poor friends at Podcast The Ride suffered through Father of the Pride, and that's the one where he was, Katzenberg was finally able to force on, like, created by credit on there. It's like, I hate when they call an executive a third director. Like, no, you're not. I feel like at least in one or two of those Shrek things I had read too, they were like, oh, he was almost like another director. He worked a lot. Like,
well, he did not want to take a lot of credit for this movie after it bombed.
Of course.
So this all begins sort of like the Hunchback project, where he approaches writers with an idea that he has. So he approaches Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio. These are the two screenwriters he helped to figure out Aladdin. He hired to help figure out Aladdin.
Right,
to all of those animators, here's how you write a movie.
That's right. Yeah, I remember you talking about that in your great history on the Aladdin one, of that those guys came in and then it felt like the animators who worked on it had to fix their shitty script or whatever.
And their first movie together they wrote was Little Monsters, the Fred Savage vehicle.
Not that great a film.
No, no. Really, no. But they went on to make much, much bigger movies. We'll talk more about those later. So I got a really good interview from the blog Cult Films and the People Who Make Them. It's just this old Blogspot blog.
But cool.
There's a very extensive interview with them, and they're very candid about their experience on this movie. A lot of this info comes from there. So as with Hunchback, this is Katzenberg approaching creatives with an idea. A bold idea. So he comes to them with a copy of this new book that came out in 1993. It was called Conquest, Montezuma, Cortez, and the Fall of Old Mexico by Hugh Thomas. This was sort of like the Guns, Germs, and Steel of the early 90s, like one of those big pop history books.
Just like how that Lincoln book came out about, I think it was Cabinet of Rivals or whatever, and then Obama talked about that as
that's a good idea for my presidency. Absolutely not. Don't ever do that.
And same with, like, Spielberg made a Lincoln film all about that. And then, of course, there was a popular Hamilton history novel, and that turned into a wonderful musical. So same deal here, it sounds like.
So Jeffrey Katzenberg's idea is, like, you know this story of untold tragedy and genocide and the loss of all of these native people? I want a movie set in that world. That was his idea.
Sounds great for children.
Yes.
For sure, yeah.
So Katzenberg told Terry and Ted the reason that other animated movies don't make Disney money is because other people are trying to make Disney movies. Disney already makes Disney movies. And his idea is, like, we're going to make a non-Disney animated movie. That is actually Shrek.
Yes,
they do that
yes,
with Shrek. They
absolutely.
Don't do that with this movie.
No, this movie is mostly a Disney movie. I saw him saying the same stuff about Prince of Egypt, where he was, like, bragging, like, you know, at Disney, I could never do a biblical movie like this. And we didn't add, like, cute friends in it, but he'd have a better argument with Prince of Egypt because the resulting movie of this has cute animal friends, you know?
And the friendly voice of Elton John to get you into the movie. But so Ted and Terry hit upon the idea that lead characters in Disney movies are boring because they have to be virtuous. So what if the sidekicks of a Disney movie hijack the movie? The sidekicks are allowed to be flawed because they're the comic relief. So they can be greedy, or they could be gluttonous. They can have these fun vices that are fun to watch. So their idea is, like, let's have a Disney movie, but the sidekicks are the lead characters.
I like that a lot. Actually, that really, you know, that vision comes through in the final movie for sure. This does lack a Belle or an Aladdin character who's just like, no, guys, we got to do this. We got to be good.
Yeah, with no other traits outside of I'm virtuous.
Yeah.
So they were really into the idea of making a comedic duo because that idea had really fallen out of fashion by the year 2000. I think in our lifetime, the one we kind of lived through was Farley and Spade.
Yes.
And there were, like, two movies.
That's true. The Farley, well, you know, hey, they would have had more.
Yeah,
right?
If not for drug problems. But, I mean, so Terry and Ted grew up in the 60s where there was, like, Martin and Lewis. Mm. And they were watching old things like Laurel and Hardy and there was a lot of other ones like Nichols and May. There was like they grew up in an
Nichols
era
May, yeah.
of all of these, both reflecting upon old comedic duos and then living through the end of that idea as a popular one. Yeah. Smothers Brothers too.
Oh like, God, yeah. I love the Smothers Brothers. I liked them a lot as a kid. Yeah, and then what did we get the decade after that? You know, Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn. Was
yeah.
that our combo?
I really hope not. And yeah, like Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis reunited in 76 when these guys are teenagers. That was like a gigantic pop culture event for boomers and like early Gen Xers. You see it referenced on early Simpsons all the time.
Yeah, more like I like on the commentaries where they have to say like, is this the third time we've referenced this reunion? It was that important to us as children.
So they were like, yeah, comedic duos are not a thing anymore. That'd be a really appealing feature. We can make a really good one in this movie. So here's a quote from Ted Elliott. Quote, that was the shorthand for let's do a movie with a pair of comedic anti-heroes, which was a mistake, I think. So was our citing the Hope Crosby Road movies as examples. If we just said, let's do a dramatic story with anti-heroes who are funny, well, maybe things have gone differently. So I think maybe the executives were too tied to their pitch.
Maybe.
Which was very specific when they thought if we had a broader pitch, we would have more room to play in this idea.
They very much stick to the Hope and Crosby stuff, which I haven't seen an actual full Hope and Crosby film, but I've watched so many cartoons
yes.
that parody it, I feel like I know it.
I think the first time I saw it was in, before Family Guy, like Tasmania. So in Tasmania, the dad is Bing Crosby. There's an episode where like an uncle visits who is Bob Hope, and they
yeah.
have an adventure like a Hope Crosby movie.
That's right. Like they ride camels or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, and then of course the Duckman one, which
yeah.
is so great too, that ends with, that has like two of my favorite intentionally bad writing jokes where they just say like, hey, wait, isn't this a giant plot hole? And then they just cut out the part where the guy says, oh, well, that makes sense. Like, that explains
or
it.
Like when Duckman loses steam on a rant, he was like, that was more of a season one kind of thing for
yeah.
me. But I mean, the Family Guy episodes are like the touchstone
yes.
most younger people have. By younger, I mean like 40 have
yeah.
for this kind of idea.
33-year-olds.
Yes.
Like, oh, yeah, I remember when Stewie and Brian went on all their road to things and sang a song. I mean, also like, Duckman, when they did theirs, they certainly did a song, but I think for Seth MacFarlane, it's like song first, all the
yes.
other farce or whatever later. We got to have the songs in place.
Yeah, the songs were the first thing on his mind. So like my idea is a boomer saw these a lot on TV as kids because
yeah.
a little side digression about the Hope Crosby Road movie. So Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, one's a comedian, one's a crooner. Very different personalities, and they play off each other well. So there were seven of these movies from 1940 to 1962. And I think the reason our generation didn't watch them is because they're not good. They're not that good. And also, they are like, let's go to exotic lands kind of movies that are comedies. So
right.
from that era, they're not going to age well, both in terms of like the quality of the jokes and also how progressive they are in terms of the humor.
Sure, yeah. I mean, well, and you know, even for his time, Bob Hope was not the most liberal guy, or Bing Crosby. And so when they go to, say, Morocco, what are they going to
yeah.
see? You know,
how many like sheiks are in this movie, like wielding scimitars and things like that? Yeah,
jokes about slavery, all the great stuff. Yeah, now I. But it must have been a lot of easy early television filler back
mm-hmm.
in the day of just all these old Hope and Crosby things. So that's why those the young people, boomers, saw that, or Xers too, I guess.
And also like meeting exotic women, usually like a white woman in a black wig.
Yeah, yeah, with a little heavy eyeshadow
yeah.
on or something, yes.
And Bob Hope doing the Conan O'Brien growl at them, usually. But yeah, so that is where this idea comes from. Obviously, like, in the Road to movies, again, like Bob Hope is like a nebbish nerd and like a jokester, and Bing Crosby is a little like more of a smooth talker. In this movie, the characters are remarkably similar, although they have different drives. Like,
yeah.
they're both like sleazebags, but one's more of a dreamer and one's more of like a greedy, horny guy.
Yeah, but they're not enough of one or the other. They more meet in the middle half the time as the type of dudes they are. But what I like about them is that it feels like they have so many more stories to tell with them. Like, these guys should go on adventures all the time. It's compared to fairy tales that have a beginning, middle, and end. these guys are much more made for sequels and Road to El Dorado direct to video, Road to El Dorado the series.
Yeah, that friggin' snail movie got a Netflix series. Why can't we have the Road to El Dorado Netflix series or Amazon series or whatever? What owns DreamWorks now?
You know,
Comcast?
Now it would be on Peacock.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the story is written up as a treatment in the spring of 95. This movie's in production for a long time, by the way. So yeah, 5 years before it's in theaters. So that's like from the initial inception to finished product. 5 years. And internally, the film was often called El Dorado, The Lost City on Hold because it was being delayed and put on the back burner so often.
That's clever. That's just like the jokes about getting Shrek to being sent to work on Shrek. But yeah.
The Shrek mines. So by January of 97, DreamWorks had assigned 100 animators to El Dorado, even though the studio was very busy with the production of Prince of Egypt, which would be launched in 98.
Man, that's a lot of spending. I mean, it's a startup. You gotta start getting working on your product right then, you know. So,
and
yeah,
this was the era in which Disney started in the early 90s, but says we have a studio in Australia and France and Florida. We're going to work with all of them to make footage for movies.
Right.
DreamWorks doesn't have that.
But they're hiring as many Disney people as they can, or in the case of PDI going up to San Francisco, like, hey, can you also be Pixar? We lost Pixar.
Yeah.
We want you to be Pixar.
Can you fill in for them? So yeah, it's really hard to figure out a definitive timeline for like which versions were in production when, because a lot of that is not public information and there were just so many different versions of the movie. According to Elliot and Rossio, the screenwriters, the total amount of written pages for this movie amount to over 5,000.
Good God.
So throughout all the versions, he added them all up and said there were over 5,000 pages written for this movie.
That feels like an extreme amount of rewrites even for a long in development film in Hollywood. That seems like a whole lot of rewrites.
And Rossio says, quote, rarely was there a full and complete draft of the film. Occasionally sequences would get assembled together. Mostly it was worked on in pieces, endlessly revising sequences.
You know, I can get a feel of that in the final film, that it feels like sometimes it feels like a puzzle piece just locked into another one instead of a continuous thread of a story.
It's like this was always here, this was added later.
We always said there'd be a giant robot jaguar, and I guess we have to put it here. We said we'd do it.
So obviously 5 years on an animated movie is a little absurd, a little unusual, and yeah, there were many production difficulties this film suffered. Initially, this movie was intended to be rated PG-13 with a much more mature story that would focus on the tragedy of the Mesoamerican people and their loss. Like, this is like any story involving Cortez is bad news. Like, it's not good.
The second you see him in this film, you're like, oh, good. He's not fun at all.
And I'm glad they make him an asshole prick.
Who also is like, upfront of like, I'm a murderer who believes that Jesus gave me the right to do so.
And a slaver, he's not like the good colonists of Pocahontas.
You know what? I feel like they're able to do that because he's like, well, he's Spanish, so we don't have to feel American guilt over American slavery. We don't have to act like it's complex. If it was a Spanish colonialist, we can just say like, oh no, they're just bad. Mm-hmm. They were just bad.
One thing I will say, I was a bit worried going into this, like how will this hold up in terms of like the treatment of indigenous people and things like that? It is way better than Pocahontas, even though there's some exoticization, whatever you want to call it, fetishization even like native people. I think it's a lot kinder and less patronizing than Pocahontas.
I definitely think it's less patronizing than Pocahontas. I think they at least, they got to learn certainly from Pocahontas' release in 95, where people dunked on it for like, oh God, this view on tribal people as like the noble savage kind of thing is just like so outdated even by 95.
Yeah, and it's like, the white man thinks all of you are savages, but then the Indians think that the white man is a savage. Isn't the answer somewhere in the middle? In this movie, it's like, no, Cortez is a demon.
Yeah.
And anything he touches will turn to shit. This is like a bad dude.
There's like one bad guy among the native people instead of all of them going to war and being like, yeah, we're both the same as the people in Jamestown, like in Pocahontas.
So here is what Ted Elliott says on the original ending for this movie. He says, quote, "The city of El Dorado, which wasn't even the mythical El Dorado, it was just the first city Tulio and Miguel found, which they mistakenly believe was El Dorado, it was not saved. The people end up abandoning it to Cortez and vanishing into the jungles. The people barely survived, and the culture did not. This was also accurate to history. Cortez encountered a number of abandoned cities on his way to the capital of the Aztec Empire, and that was our answer to the question, what happened to the Mayans?"
Boy, that's, I mean, if they want to stick Hugh even closer to history. That's about as untragic as it's going to get of like, oh, yeah. There was nobody there for him to murder, like, or enslave. Yeah.
The ending of the movie is a little politically correct in the old sense of the term, in that it's like, oh no, everyone was happy and they lived together in El Dorado forever. It's like, no, Cortez is still in what would be Mexico, and he's going to be fucking everything up for those people.
Yeah.
He's not leaving. He's not going back to Spain.
They make it the nicest they can be is like, well, he just never discovered these people. It was always the lost city of El Dorado, and they got to keep existing separate from the colonialism that ravaged the rest of that entire global South. Like they were safe from it somehow and always were. Yeah. It's an easy fairy tale ending in that way, for sure.
It's a bit unrealistic, but hey, it's about a fake city. So few sources talk about depictions of Mesoamerican people in this movie. I was surprised. But what we see here is not just one culture, but a blending of many different cultures of that region, some like hundreds of years apart. So we have Mayans, we have Aztecs, we have Incans, and we have Olmecs. And that means they can not only stick to one civilization, they can use a blending of them, which, again, you're conflating a lot of different kinds of people with very different lifestyles. But also, I feel that you're not going to be offending anybody. Even though technically these people no longer exist, but their predecessors do exist.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of slamming together of things, that is just a very, you know, flattening of history thing that it's the equivalent of saying like George Washington and Abraham Lincoln hung out all the time with FDR. You just slam together 300 years like they're all the same time. But for ignorant Americans who barely know American history, if you want to talk about global history, they don't understand it. You know, like something that happens in 1519 in this film, or if it happened in 1650, basically that's the same time in our memories.
It's easier to make movies about people who don't exist anymore because there's no one left to offend.
That's true.
About lost civilizations.
Yeah. Like about the Inuit people.
Yeah. Or Rome.
Or Rome.
Say whatever you want about Rome. Yeah. Those are all dead. So, okay, originally this original version of the movie would be a lot racier, okay? Mm-hmm. So we have, I didn't find any images of this, unfortunately, but I found the idea, like, spicier clothing for Chell was in the original PG-13 version.
It's so spicy as it is. How do you spice that up? Hearing that PG-13 thing is really interesting because you can definitely see that bubbling to the surface with stuff that happens. Like, these guys swear.
Yeah. Chell is smoking hot.
Hell yeah,
and not afraid to show it off.
No, I know. And she is into wanting casual sex with an unmarried man. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
And there's going to be more romance in the movie. In our Hunchback podcast, it did feel like that movie was making baby steps towards a mature adult animated movie that Disney quickly retreated from, and they were going to do the same thing with this movie, but they didn't even, you know, execute it at all, really.
You know, Hunchback, they got that got Disney scared of, like, oh, people, like you said, Jason Alexander had said in some interview, like, I don't think I'd take my 5-year-old to this. Disney's like, oh no. And I would be at Katzenberg could have seen the box office results of Hunchback and thinking, like, oh, they went too far.
So, like, some original elements of the movie still exist within the finished film. But then there's a lot of stuff that you're wondering, like, well, who is this for? So we have, like, sexy Chell and, like, a bit of swearing. But then we have, like, nobody really dies, you know?
Yeah.
There's one man who is crushed by the giant panther, spoilers. And because children at test screenings found that so traumatizing, they add, I'm okay, or whatever.
Yeah, so they're like, I'm okay, splat. I'm still okay.
Yeah.
Jim Cummings shouldn't do so many incidental characters.
Yes.
That's a general note I have.
That was a note of mine. It's like, all right, he's already Cortez and he's this one native. Does he have to be all of them who talk?
I know. We all love Jim Cummings' voice, but
it can be distracting. So the original version of El Dorado is scheduled tentatively for the fall of 1999 because Katzenberg wants to beat Disney's Kingdom of the Sun to the box office.
I thought so.
Which would be released in December of 2000 as The Emperor's New Groove.
Which also, that's a whole I have a feeling if we ever do that one, that's a whole podcast on its own of incredibly complicated, complex problem.
I mean, there's no evidence on the record, but it's a big smoking gun that Katzenberg had his own, like, Mesoamerican serious movie that became a comedy, just like the Disney movie. Like, they realized, like, this is too mature. We have to make this about a talking llama. Let's go.
And also, it has a soundtrack led by a famous guy, but Sting, except Sting, they hacked away every Sting song but one song. Like, that I've only seen clips from it, but I gotta watch the full authorized documentary, The Sweatbox, that Sting's wife did about the attempt to make Kingdom of the Sun.
Are there any songs like in Emperor's New Groove? I haven't seen it for a while. Like, within the movie, like sung songs?
Yeah, well, there's a comedy song sung by Tom Jones about him. And then over the credits, there's a Sting song. And I think there's like one other song, but I don't think it's a Sting song.
It's just funny that this idea existed both at DreamWorks and Disney, but they both could not make the serious movie that they planned on making.
You deal with all this. It just gets more and more complicated as it goes. And eventually, in Disney's case, they decided, like, let's just anchor this around David Spade's voice and have just a bunch of really silly sitcom-y jokes, must-see TV sitcom jokes of the 90s.
It's a very funny movie.
I love that movie.
So who directs this movie? Who at first is assigned to direct it? Well, a friend of the show, David Silverman of The Simpsons, and also Will Finn are attached as directors, but then they leave the project when the many changes that came about did not reflect their creative vision. When I see Tulio, I think he is a David Silverman design, and I don't have that on the record, but something about him makes me think of a Silverman drawing.
His ruffled hair definitely has a Silverman feel to it, for sure. And, I mean, it reminds me a little of Silverman's own, like, caricatures of himself with that kind of, like, puffy hair and beard line. I would guess, based on the timeline, this is what hired away Silverman from The Simpsons as series director. Mm-hmm. Like, because season 8 would have... production of that would have ended right around when he'd hopped on to work on this film in like 98 or 97.
So once he leaves DreamWorks, he goes, of course, to Pixar, works on Monsters, Inc. But I mean, we have his email address. We can just ask him. I really want to know, like, what did you have any impact at all on what the finished movie looks like today?
I've always wanted to do, I mean, someday we're definitely doing a part 2 interview with Mr. Silverman. And he was, I sent him an email not too long ago going like, yeah, I'd like to talk to him, you again if you ever wanted to. And he said, I'm very busy right now, but it's in the future. Yeah.
I'll hold him to that. And so who is Will Finn? Attached to all kinds of stuff. He would later co-direct Home on the Range, which unlike Road to El Dorado, actually made a healthy profit for Disney.
Really? Man,
yes.
That one, that is known as the killer of 2D films at Disney, but it was more profitable than this.
That is the Disney brand difference, where it's just like, the new Disney movie is out, let's go see that, and then people do.
That's true.
DreamWorks still an unknown quantity at this point. So not a huge profit for Disney. So it cost $110 million to make Home on the Range, but it made $145 million. So barely a profit. I could see why they kind of stopped, but still, it was profitable.
I mean, if that makes that amount of profit and Chicken Little somehow does better than that, it's like, okay, let's stick with 3D.
And you know, I have not seen it. I do want to see it. I'm sure it has really good 2D animation, so who knows?
I've only seen clips from it in the reels of James Baxter or Bruce W. Tim. And his, like, they did a character animation for it that looks really, really good.
And that was the last 2D animated movie before Princess and the Frog, right?
Yes.
I thought so. So you might be asking, why the changes from the original version of this movie? Why did they not make the you know, family-friendly but still a little racier PG-13 movie that they wanted to make? Well, as DreamWorks was working on this movie, The Prince of Egypt released, and while it was a success, it was not the mega hit Katzenberg wanted for his new studio. Again, he leaves Disney after The Lion King. The Lion King, at that point, before, I think, Toy Story 2, is the highest grossing animated movie of all time, and he is just like, we got to make one of those for ourselves.
Right. Well, and part of, you know, the mania that Katzenberg had at the time was, in the, you know, Variety or whatever, the stories were... was it Katzenberg or what? Who can take credit for the success of those Disney films, Katzenberg or Eisner? And if Katzenberg at his new DreamWorks thing could have hits as big as Disney, it would prove it was him, not Eisner. He could answer the doubters that, like, no, I was the secret behind this. And I mean, of course, that's also why he wanted Disney to fail as much as possible, because it would be proof that without him, then they would fail and it was all Katzenberg, which is not the case.
It's weird that, like, some sources I was looking at called Prince of Egypt a bomb, because it was made for $70 million and it grossed over $200 million.
Yeah, that's good.
But But the same year, Mulan actually earned $100 million more than Prince of Egypt. So it made like $100 million more than its budget compared to Prince of Egypt.
Well, and Prince of Egypt really didn't have like the long tail like on VHS that any Disney film did. Like it didn't become a must buy for kids or show your kids thing. It didn't lead to like also
less merchandising.
Yeah. Well, who's going to merchandise, you know, the burning bush or Moses or baby Moses or whatever?
Yeah.
You know?
So Prince of Egypt made $218 million. Mulan made $304 million.
I think probably the biggest success for Prince of Egypt was the soundtrack, really, yeah. I bet. Yeah.
Some sources I read were like, Jeffrey can't blame the Bible if El Dorado fails, because apparently it was like, nobody cares about the Bible.
Well, hey, that's your mistake then, buddy, trying to be, you know, much like this Hope and Crosby idea that really that hooked in with the executives. I feel like Katzenberg on Prince of Egypt, he's like, oh, biblical epics like in my childhood. That's what people want to watch. It's like not in the late
90s. I didn't even want to watch those old ones on TV because they were all like 4 hours long.
With commercials, especially. Yeah, it's just like how many times have they remade Ben-Hur and no one cares? Like, yeah.
So The Road to El Dorado has turned into much more of a comedy to overcorrect in reaction to the fairly grounded Prince of Egypt and how poorly it performed in their eyes. Again, it made a lot of money. It made a lot of money, but not enough.
It's even more surprising to me that then Silverman would leave the project then, because comedy, like he is a master of comedy, like he's an animated comedy master. I would think he'd be even more suited to it, but I guess I could also see him after you losing a year or 2 years of work on this thing, just going like, fuck this.
Yeah,
I'm out of here.
I need to actually put something out.
Yeah.
Actually, the one remark on the record that I read from Silverman on this that I could find was him commenting on how present Jeffrey Katzenberg was during the production, because Katzenberg at this point throughout the production of this movie embroiled in his lawsuit, his breach of contract lawsuit with Disney that was not settled until July of 1999. And he was even more hands-on with the film after that to make up for the time that lawsuit took him away from the project. But apparently, according to David Silverman, he was always there even though he was busy with the lawsuit. He was putting in more time after work to make up for the lawsuit stealing away from time from him. How much did he make from that lawsuit? Like hundreds of millions?
I think it was at least $200 million, maybe even $300 million. Yeah, but that shows you, too, the insane workaholic he is that like, you make $300 million and you're like, well, I still have to do 17-hour days. Like, I have to talk to people all the time to make this movie.
Only a broken workaholic could be worth, I don't know, $500 million and still want to create a streaming network in his 60s.
Right, yeah.
Just retire.
Just retire and terrorize the homeless around Los Angeles, you know?
So at one point, supervising animator for Tulio, James Baxter, an amazing animator. He was the lead for Quasimodo and Hunchback, and he's got an amazing career. He's described as a bashful Brit in my source, and he stepped up to Katzenberg, very unlike him. And he said, you got to back off. You don't know what you're doing, and you're going to ruin this movie.
Damn.
And Katzenberg actually listened because he respected Baxter, but that only lasted for a few weeks.
That makes sense. You know, on the Lion King one, it was Elton John, the story was, that he was able to tell him, like, stop calling me. I don't want to talk. But Baxter had to be his, like, he'd be right up there as one of the top gets he stole from Disney. Because, like, Baxter was the iconic animator of so many scenes.
He was right to headhunt him.
Yeah.
So also, once he won that lawsuit, I read that he really believed that nothing he could do was wrong.
No.
He believed every opinion he had was correct because he beat Disney in court.
I could absolutely see that affecting your brain very negatively. Yes. Yeah. You're like, oh, I am God. I'm God now.
I think only Scientologists had better lawyers than Disney at the time. So if you actually beat Disney in court and win hundreds of millions of dollars from them, you are a god on earth.
That is pretty impressive, man. Yeah. You know, in the Disney War book, it's all about that. And they mentioned that, like, David Geffen was kind of backing him in this, and David Geffen was telling Michael Eisner, like, you need to settle for $150 million with him or else you will lose and it'll be even worse. And Eisner didn't believe him, but Geffen was right. Yeah.
Take it from us, listeners. Don't settle for just $150 million. That's a loser's game. So in the interview I read with Ellie and Horacio, they were very down on the movie. And you know what? More first impressions to follow once we talk about the movie itself. I was pleasantly surprised by this movie. It has flaws, but I thought it was enjoyable.
Yeah.
They are very down on it. Like, one of the opening remarks in their interview, the guy is asking, like, how did the movie differ from your original vision? And they were like, our original vision was to make a good movie.
Oh, damn. I mean, when you're that close to it, I get it. I've seen people say about, you know, these very critically regarded movies, even the creators of those will go like, I only see the flaws or I only see what's wrong. So I get it. But still, like, dude, like, there's so much hard work on screen here.
They at least appreciate the animation, but
that's good.
More on what their qualms are with the movie. So they intended for the songs in the movie to fit in with the Howard Ashman tradition in which the songs are necessary to tell the story. The songs were written, and then the story changed greatly from the original direction. Even though the songs went through major revisions, they still feel out of place in the movie. And apparently, Jeffrey felt like Elton John, his mere presence will make this a success. But once that was not true, he was done with Elton John.
Oh, damn, man. That's Katzenberg, a fickle, fickle friend, that guy.
Like, as soon as Spirit started up, he was like, we are using Bryan Adams.
Oh, man.
Elton John is dead to us now.
Like, Bryan Adams is fine, but that feels like a trade down from Elton John. Though, the songs in this movie, I mean, they don't feel like Elton is given 100%, I'd say.
There's two goodish songs, and the song I really like is not actually in the movie. And it's a single for the movie. We'll talk more about the songs later, but that's
so funny that it ended the working relationship of Katzenberg and Elton John.
And also, in my opinion, like, with the newer, lighter direction of the movie, the characters should be singing more. In fact, like, going into this movie, I'm like, okay, it's like Tarzan. This contemporary singer will be singing throughout the movie, not the characters. Then the characters get a song. I'm like, you got to make up your minds, guys, because I like it when the characters are singing more. If they sing only once, I'm distracted during the Elton John stuff. I'm like, I want these guys to be singing their hearts out.
The film really comes alive when they sing. Like, that's some of the most, like, energy the movie has is them singing. But the songs that they have from Elton John, those guys shouldn't sing. Like, they shouldn't be singing, like, I Will Always Love You or whatever, or The Road to El Dorado. Like, that wouldn't make sense for the characters of Tulio Miguel to sing them.
But I guess they weren't willing to throw out the songs they paid for, like they did with Sting.
Yeah, I mean...
Like Disney did with Sting, rather.
Yeah, I guess, you know, they did pay a whole lot of money for those songs, so...
I wonder how much of the $90 million budget was Elton John. Was it, like, $20 million?
I mean, to get him and Tim Rice to do it, that had to be, I would bet, at least $10 million, with a promise of X percentage of every soundtrack sale.
So the two leads were originally meant to overcome flaws, personal flaws, and then make the right decision. In the finished movie, they just simply make the right decision without overcoming personal flaws.
Yeah.
They feel like that's not interesting. Like, these characters need to overcome something because they're dirtbags, but they're also too virtuous, you know? Mm. They don't need to be convinced to do the right thing. They just do it.
They feel guilty from the beginning, and it's like, there's, I don't know if that was another of their complaints, but there's a lot of coincidences that have to happen in this movie.
That was not listed, but there's a lot of very comedic coincidences some of them are just like, there's just too many for it to be believable.
Sure, which makes it at least good as a comedy, but if you want to have dramatic stakes, kind of takes that away if just like, oh, an incredibly lucky thing happened again for them.
So they did not like where it was going, but they stayed on the project to work on it because they really like the characters and they hope they can steer things in the right direction. Ted Elliott says, quote, "Unfortunately, those story solutions were predicated on the ability of the people involved to understand what story is or listen to people who did. Neither happened."
Damn.
And after they worked on Shrek, Elliott and Rossio would go back to Disney. And guess what they did? Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, well.
They wrote four of the five movies, and they have to be worth $1 billion now.
Yeah, that's, you know, again, not all of those movies are that great, but can't argue with the success on that. That they were right to get out of town after Shrek. Well, I mean, like, their Shrek is not... all the shit they did on Shrek probably is barely in the film either anyway.
Yeah, weren't there like 20 screenwriters on Shrek?
Yeah, I didn't even mention these guys because it's like, well, from what I could tell, the script was a suggestion to all the storyboarders, and really it was like the head of story just rewrote the whole damn thing. I believe the version those guys worked on had Shrek's parents in them, and he wanted to be a knight.
Okay.
You know?
So based on the commentary, which is very good, I went at, it's on the Blu-ray you lent me, Henry, it seems like a lot of scenes were cut. They went through a lot of test screenings, and many scenes with finished animation were cut, which is very rare in feature animation. Yeah.
Yeah, well, because like, on some scenes of like 5 minutes of feature animation probably costs more than like two episodes of a TV cartoon. Like, it's just your mileage per minute because you're getting so many original drawings and a lot of it not outsourced or sent overseas, but original by the character leading supervising animator plus the support staff, like, who are very expensive, like the man hours involved. And that's just for like the line work. Then if you're going to color it,
yeah,
and do it for full, like 70 millimeter, well, not 70, but full widescreen digital, like, that's not
and
cheap.
That was not available on the Blu-ray. I don't think it was ever made available, those cutscenes.
That sucks.
Yeah.
Well, I would guess too, for DreamWorks, they're just like, no, that's in the past. We don't want to show our mistakes, but oh God, what? That's even more of a waste. That's what Blu-rays are made for, to have those kind of extras on there.
Yeah, sometimes they're clear about like what was cut out or like different variations of scenes, but they were clear, like, most of the stuff that was cut out was better introductions, in my opinion, better introductions for Chell, Zekel Khan, and Chief Tanabok, because they thought, okay, it's going to be better for if the viewer sees El Dorado for the first time when the characters do. So initially, in this original version of the movie, we see what's up with Chell. We see the relationship with Zekel Khan and Tanabok before Miguel and Julio meet them. But they thought, like, what they're doing when they first meet is enough to tell you about who they are. I would say possibly true with Zekel Khan and Tanabok, but with Chell, you have a lot of questions about her that remain unanswered. Like, who is she? What was she doing? Why does she not believe in this stuff? Like, did
she
come from somewhere else?
Who is she to the rest of the town?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, why was she leaving? She never says, I was trying to leave for this. I mean, you just have to assume she's a thief, like, that she's like, she stole a thing and wanted to get out of there.
Like, to me, like, my backstory, it was like she had infiltrated this place as a long con to steal from them, which is why she knows about all these rituals, but she's not from there.
Yeah, it makes sense, because she doesn't seem to have a relationship to any other person there. She doesn't miss them. She doesn't go like, oh, bye to my family. Like, yeah, she seems to be just as much an interloper as those guys are. It just that she is from the area instead of Spain, mm-hmm. like the very white Spanish guys that Miguel and Tulio are.
I want more Chell in this movie.
Well, I no, I mean, yeah, she's, I do understand that the story drive for that you want the audience to be as impressed with El Dorado as they are the first time. And if you see it beforehand and that it's not just a legend,
yeah,
it removes some dramatic tension, I guess.
And sure. I mean, like, from a story point, it'd be satisfying to see more of what's up with Chell, but I think it actually redeems her character a bit more, because a lot of Chell is just like, look at this babe, like,
yes,
look at her, she's sexy, she knows it,
mm-hmm,
she's gonna
horny.
Use that, yeah. And that's cool in a way, I like,
yeah,
that,
yeah.
But also it's like, she is often just eye candy and there's nothing more to her, and like, why does she want to help these guys? Like, I wish we found out more about her.
Me too, yeah.
So funny timing on this, Henry. So the year 2000 Oscars happen on March 26th. This movie comes out on March 31st. So what happens on the Oscars for 2000, DreamWorks hits it big, takes home Oscar gold for American Beauty.
Oh, right.
Best Picture, right. Best Director, Best Actor, Best Original Screenplay, Best Cinematography, nominated for way more things than that, but it wins like all the top Oscars.
That is in the time, at the time, and I was super into watching the Oscars then. It was seen as like, what an important film, what a great, wonderful movie, an American classic. And even before all the Kevin Spacey stuff happened, even before that, people just didn't think about it anymore. Like, it was just gone. If you did think about it, you'd think of how the dialogue is like silly, or this is like, oh, this is a too full of itself movie.
I saw the like pre-Oscar re-release of the movie when I was 18. I was like, this is an important movie.
I felt very important at it. Yeah,
Suburbs are bullshit, man.
Yeah, oh, I'm gonna have to work a job for the rest of my life and hate it. I gotta get and also like, oh, a closeted guy shoots a guy in the back of the head. It's just. And also, you know, I'm glad I watched it when I was 16, because now I'd feel uncomfortable seeing Thor Birch at 16 do a nude scene.
Hey, her weirdo parents said it was okay.
Really effed up.
Yeah. But yes, so they hit it big with that movie, starring the great Kevin Spacey. And then 5 days later, their next movie, Road to El Dorado, completely eats shit. It brings in $12 million in its first weekend and then is like quickly ushered out of theaters.
Ouch. Oh, damn. Yeah. That, I, you know, again, in that DreamWorks history book I was reading, it was a big thing that hurt Katzenberg years in like 95 or 96. He finds out that like Spielberg doesn't want him that involved in the live action stuff, that he's just going to be animation, which Katzenberg was pissed off about because he wanted to work in live action. And then here it is in the year 2000, the live action guys who he barely was involved in, they have the biggest Oscar winner in forever. And then 5 days later, his little cartoon just like eats shit. Like, like,
And I honestly don't know why the movie did so badly. Like, it didn't have the Disney brand behind it. I forget how it was marketed, but upon watching it for the first time, I thought, like, more people should have seen this. Maybe it didn't deserve to be a mega hit, but I'm surprised, like, just nobody cared.
I wonder if it was, you know, obviously marketing, especially for the kids' audiences, is a big part of it. As much as we love The Lion King, if it didn't have that first trailer for it, would we have gone to... I mean, we would have gone to see it because of the Disney brand, but, like, when we did Mask of the Phantasm, I remember the retrospectives about it, like Bruce Timm was saying, we had no clue how to release a film into theaters and how to market it specifically that way, and it's why nobody watched it. And it seems like could be another issue here that you would think that the DreamWorks people would be better at marketing it. It seems like it definitely is a cut bait kind of moment that they didn't even give it a chance to have a second weekend.
Yeah, it's like, this is embarrassing. Let's just forget this ever happened, which is a real shame.
Yeah.
And honestly, the writing was on the wall for 2D animation at this time. I mean, Toy Story came out in 95. It was a big hit. Toy Story 2 came out in November of 99, right. Like a few months before this movie. It became the third highest grossing animated movie of all time, right behind The Lion King and Aladdin.
Maybe it was just being the first big 2D animated movie after the Christmas of Toy Story 2 that just, like, it damaged it too much. Like, people were just like, nah, I don't need this. Yeah.
So this movie had a budget of $95 million, which was standard for an animated movie at the time, 2D animated movie. It took in $50 million domestically. And what did Toy Story 2 bring in? Nearly $500 million. So Toy Story 2 makes 10 times the profit of Real Del Dorado, a movie that cost about the same to make.
Yeah. Well, and then you put in, like, marketing budget and attempts at toys. Yeah, it's rough for all the folks involved in that.
And even though DreamWorks makes Spirit and Sinbad, once Shrek comes out in 2001, they're like, this is all we're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, Spirit was so far along, and same with Sinbad. You can't really, to fully stop the train, then you're losing even more money, so you just got to finish it. But a year later, once Shrek shows them what actual success is, they're not going to greenlight any more 2D films after that.
Yeah, they're like, we need CG movies that we can also turn into franchises.
Yeah, and CG is the way. I mean, I hate to say it, like, you can't argue with that success. Like, if it's always about a business, then a thing that makes $500 million, or honestly, in Shrek's case, almost $1 billion, is worth way more than a film that makes $100 million.
I did feel guilty upon watching this that I never paid money to see it in a theater because I didn't appreciate what I had.
It's true.
I like CG animated movies. They're great. They can look amazing, but there's something about this craft that is different and impressive in a different way that is just not done anymore. And it's a shame that we can't have, like, five of these a year, or, like, at least three of these a year like we used to.
This film is full of, like, so many craftsmen, James Baxter at the front of the line, but, like, so many people who have a craft that would very soon become very undervalued, and those guys would have to, like, specialize and freelance it here and there, or learn how to make it work somehow in 3D, in like how Brad Bird had to learn how to make things work in 3D for Incredibles.
So let's talk about the talent of The Road to El Dorado. We talked about the making of and the failure of the movie. Let's talk about who the people who made it. So it's directed by two guys, not David Silverman and the other guy, but Bebo Bergeron, Eric Bergeron, and Don Paul. Not Ron Paul, but Don Paul.
Man.
Yes. Unfortunate
name. Names, but yeah. not the real guys.
So Bebo Bergeron is a French animator with a lovely French accent. You can hear it on the commentary. He got to start animating on, guess what he was animating in France, Henry?
DuckTales?
No. What famous French character?
Oh, Asterix?
Exactly. I was going to say he's a Gaul.
All right.
Animated on Asterix movies and also Babar, King of the Elephants.
Man, that's so he knows how to do colonialism animation well then with the Babar work.
And I think he knew that or worked with the Breezy brothers who were doing the DuckTales movie and had their own French studio. So I think there's some connection there.
I would think 2D animation in France is a small pod.
I would hope so. There's not a lot going on there, but he did not work at Disney. He worked on also ran animated movies in America, like An American Tale, Five Goes West, We're Back, A Dinosaur Story, and then Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest. Lots of TV stuff around this time, too, mostly animated in France.
Right. This that sounds to me like it was the Amblimation becomes DreamWorks Animation pipeline that this guy went through. Yeah.
And I wasn't sure if he was living in the States for this because Amblin had like an Irish studio. So maybe he was in Ireland doing this.
Right. Yeah. He might have been. I think that was like an offshoot too of like the Don Bluth studio was in Ireland. And then once Bluth and Spielberg split and Amblimation was like, we're just going to make this shit without Don Bluth and hire as many guys from that as we can. I think that was where Amblimation Ireland was. They had a Burbank Amblimation as well.
Why Ireland? Massive tax breaks. Yep, yeah. Which is why I think Apple's an Irish company, technically.
All right, yeah. I think those tax breaks close. I mean, why are there so many Montreal video game studios, you know? Like, it's always about the taxes. The finger thing means the taxes. I'm doing it now, listeners.
So he worked uncredited at DreamWorks for some of their early movies. He was a story artist and animator on Ants and Prince of Egypt. So he co-directs both this movie and Shark Tale, and then is involved in almost every DreamWorks CGI movie up through 2012's Madagascar 3. Yes, they made three of these movies.
Oh, yeah. And that doesn't even count the Penguins installments, spin-off movies, too.
You know what? They're all right.
They're fine. They're fine. Hey, if that gets the directors or the animators who voice them some big paychecks, I'm all for it.
And in 2011, Bebo wrote and directed the non-DreamWorks CGI feature, French feature, A Monster in Paris. So that's his own movie, which is he's trying to get off the ground for a long time, apparently.
Interesting. Oh, that's cool. Good for him.
Don Paul, this guy is kind of a mystery. This is his only directing credits.
Huh.
All of his other credits are for effects animation in movies like An American Tale, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, The Black Cauldron, Aladdin, Pocahontas, The Land Before Time, The Little Mermaid, and a lot of other movies. His last credit is effects animation in the 2004 direct-to-DVD Three Musketeers movie with Mickey, Donald, and Goofy playing the Three Musketeers.
Wow, man. I'm not saying it never happens, but in all the times we've looked at the people who become directors, it's very rare that I see they come out of the effects department. Like, that is a very important skill and everything.
Yeah, like smoke and fire and water and explosions. Like, it's a very specific skill.
But most of the directors were, like, often they come from the story department or in some rare cases, like, character design or animation, like, the Lilo and Stitch directors, they both, I believe, came out of character design as their main deal. But yeah, it's very rare I hear of a specialist in special effects being a director of any of the films we've covered on the podcast.
So yeah, Bebo would go on to direct a few of the things, but Don Paul, not so much. But you know what? They did a great job animation-wise with this movie. It looks great.
The execution of the animation is the strongest point of this movie. Like, it's top-of-the-line stuff. Like, if their aim was to match a Disney's 90 film quality, they did it.
Definitely. I totally agree. So those are the directors, and let's talk about the composers of the movie. So songs are by, we just talked about them in our last podcast, Elton John and Tim Rice, the same guys behind The Lion King, but lightning did not strike twice for them, and the Road to El Dorado soundtrack did not generate any contemporary hits, although there is a single that I was jamming out to on the way over here. Let me play a little bit of it. It is called Someday Out of the Blue, and I'm surprised I never heard this in a grocery store or in a dentist's office or while getting my haircut. Pretty good contemporary pop hit. It's like a real VH1 classic. And the music video, I had you watch a bit of this, Henry. They spend at least 3 minutes of feature animation just putting a feature animation style Elton John into scenes of the movie. They had to spend a ton of money just doing that.
Had to be so much money. Man, it makes me think that Elton John complained that he wanted to be drawn into the Can You Feel the Love Tonight video, and they instead, you know, blue screened him in. And
yeah,
this was finally, he's like, all right, if I'm gonna do another one of these, you draw me. I want to see me drawn into it.
He is playing a piano in front of like a backdrop, but there's more to the video than that.
I don't know why that didn't really catch, other than just the film disappearing, but it's like, that's a fine little song. I
like it more than Can You Feel the Love Tonight.
I guess it just wasn't the time. 2000, it was a meaner time, I guess. I don't know.
I will say, like, the songs don't all work. We talked a bit about it up front, but there's 2 to 3-ish goodish songs in this, but the worst songs in this are the ones that are like, El Dorado, a city. Like, I hate the literal songs in this. I like the more abstract songs, although one of them is used in a very strange way. There's like a love song in the movie, but it's not, like, the montage it's set up against is not a love montage.
It's about a guy liking a town.
Yeah,
And the people of it not falling in love. Well, and that song is like kind of a breakup song, which I can see why they didn't put that in over a scene in the movie, because they're already trying to not make the two men who are longtime partners seem gay. And then here's this song about like sung by a very famous gay man.
Yeah.
About like, someday I'll see you and our eyes will meet. And like, Julio and Miguel go through a breakup in the movie of their partnership. And if you were to play this song about like, someday we'll fall in love again or we'll see each other.
Yeah.
That makes it more gay, I think.
Instead, there's a song about like friendship in this movie. But yeah, when I was listening to this on the walk over, I was like, I like this song in like an Elton Johnny kind of way, but this has nothing to do with the movie.
No.
It's about like, I had a breakup and, you know, one day we'll meet again.
And also the music doesn't really have the feel of like, you know, South American style to it either. Like, though I guess, you know, I think in The Lion King, the other composers reworked a lot more of Elton John's music to have more of a feel of, you know, African rhythms and stuff. Especially Hans Zimmer on Circle of Life worked very hard on reworking it to have it make it feel more of the continent. Hot afternoons, still follow me. Someday out of the blue, maybe years from now or tomorrow night, I'll turn and I'll see you as if we always knew. Someday we would live again someday soon.